Welcome to the eighth message of our series, Fight for Faith, a study of the life of David. Keep watching as we look at the different relationships that impacted David's life after his battle with Goliath, and as we see the power of authentic friendship and the importance of not only pursuing friendships, but also of being the right kind of friend to others. Now, we're going to jump right into this passage here this morning, and I want you to see, as we dive into chapter 18, all these things are taking place after King David after David as a young man fought Goliath. And some we're going to just jump right into it. It's after 17. We looked at a little at the beginning of chapter 18 next week, and we're told that right after that battle that Saul wouldn't let David return to his father's house. That in a sense he insisted that David would live at or near the palace. And what we're seeing is that all these events here are taking place while David's living right there close to Saul. And it's also important to recognize that, as we're going to see, that we're going to go very quickly, but these are all taking place over a long period of time. And so we're going to see again is here that more than anything, you have this time defined by this hatred of Saul, of David, his opposition. And so that's that hatred and opposition. On the other hand, you have Jonathan's friendship. And in the middle of this, you see the importance of friendship, the importance of authentic friendship. There's a real sense that even as Saul was turning against David, he's trying to kill him, what you see is that Jonathan did everything in his power to try to save him. That Jonathan is acting as his friend, and there's a real sense that as you have this description, literally in chapter 18 and 23, of David and Jonathan twice affirming this covenant, this promise of friendship, in the middle of this you have the opposition of Saul. There's a sense that what we're being told here is that in this most dangerous period of David's life, that God used Jonathan to protect David. There was a sense that Jonathan wouldn't have survived, or David wouldn't have survived except for the friendship of Jonathan, and that God used that, and it's teaching us something. It's teaching us about the importance of friendship. I love Proverbs chapter 17. It says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. That there's a kind of true friendship that is there not only when it's good, but that is there when it's hard. And one of the things that I think is being taught here, it's not just about what happened in David's life. There's something here that we realize that we all need the kind of friends who are so deep that they're going to be there when it's hard. Because the reality is this, is that we're not going to make it through the hard times of life without true friends. And we're not going to make it through life without really hard times. And so in reality, it's going to make it really hard to make it through life unless we have those true friends. And the reason is because we were created that way. You go back all the way to Genesis chapter 2. And what you find is in the very Garden of Eden, before there was sin, before there was fallenness, everything is perfect. Adam is in paradise. And in the midst of that, in that perfect setting, God says this, it is not good that the man should be alone. I'll make a helper fitting for him. Now, we could get into this and what it teaches about marriage and what it teaches about gender and all those things. Those are all important points. But there's one thing that's at the core here that even in a sense is more basic than that. Even in the Garden of Eden, even in the place of perfection, the Garden of Eden wasn't enough without friendship. Paradise wasn't enough for Adam until he had a friend. And God has created us that we have this desperate need. We are created with an inherent need, something that's at the core of our being, for close relationships. That they're foundational to who we are. Because we're created in the image of God, and God is a relational God. And so you look at this, and so God has created us with this deep need. And you see in Adam, he was lonely, he was incomplete. Even if life was perfect, he needed relationships. And you know what? The fact is, we don't live in a Garden of Eden anymore. We live in a fallen world where there's a reality of sin, where there's a reality of brokenness, where there's reality of people coming against us, of trial, of crisis. And the fact is that if Adam needed this in Eden, we need it all the more in the brokenness of our world. What changes isn't our need, and in fact, our need is probably deeper. What changes is because of sin, it's harder to be able to find those friendships, to have that trust. We, by nature, we hide. And so we look at this and we say, we have this desperate need. But part of that is, as we see the desperate need, we also have to realize that not all friendships are alike. It's not just a statement of saying we need friendships. We need something that is true and that is authentic, that is deep, that is rooted in the right foundation. And there are many people that will claim to be friends, and the fact is that they're not all the same. What we're called to do is we're called to discern the character and quality of those who claim to be friends, and discern in that, seeing there's a quality of friendship. And we see this played out here in the story of David in these chapters here. Now, the first type of friend that is described here, that is illustrated by the actions of King Saul. And that's friends with selfish motives and destructive intent. Now, I know right off the bat, some of you might be saying, wait a second, I know this story. I know King Saul. You can't call him a friend. I mean, he wasn't a friend. He was David's enemy. You know, he's trying to kill David. That's not a friend at all. Now, here's what I want you to remember, is that sometimes when we read these stories, when we know the stories, what we tend to do is we tend to read in what we know, and we don't experience it as the people in the story experienced it. And not only that, but when we read through it here, what we have is we have statements throughout the story telling us something about Saul's thinking. And so we're told that he was jealous. We're told that he hated him. We're told these secret thinkings. But the fact is, the people going through the story didn't have that kind of statement. They didn't have that clue. All they looked at is they looked at the events that was going on, and they could see from the events and what the claims were. And what I want you to realize is that if you look through chapters, especially 18 and 19, until chapter 20, when he obviously turns against David, in the first couple of chapters, likely covering a number of years, Saul was claiming to be David's friend. Remember that after the victory, Saul said, I don't want you to go back to your home. I want you to be here with me. He insisted that he live in the capital, in the palace, by part of the household of Saul, by the invitation of Saul. Yes, we're told that he had evil motives, but the people didn't see the evil motives. What they saw is that what we're told is Saul is consistently promoting David. He's now putting him in charge of 1,000 people. He's making him a general. And again, remember, this is a young guy. He's in his teens. And he's promoting him, and he's first of all bringing him in his household. He's promoting him. He's giving him positions of authority. He then promises one of his daughters in marriage, saying that you'll be my son-in-law. And when that one doesn't work out, he eventually then gives one of his other daughters, Michael. And when you look at that, those are all the actions visibly of a friend and a supporter. And so when we look at this, we've got to realize that, yeah, there are going to be people like Saul in our life who at times claim to be a friend, who claim, visibly, well, look what I'm doing. Look at the positions I'm giving you. And they will claim it, but deep down, they're not our friend. And the reason why is this, is when we think of friends, they claim to be friends who are looking out for our interests. But let's take the example of Saul. Who was Saul really concerned about? Saul. It was all about him. He was concerned about his own interests. And because he was concerned about himself, then he looked at other people and he valued them and the relationship with them by the degree that they helped him. So initially he looked at David and he said, well, okay, he's helping me. I'm going through these hard emotional times. He plays the lyre for me and it makes me feel better. He's a friend. Boy, Goliath, I don't know what to do. He solved that problem for me. Boy, I want him around me. He's a friend. But what happened is, and I think this is not just Saul, I think that most people, unfortunately, their natural tendency is that we value friendships based on what can you do for me? How can you help me? And unfortunately, this often even goes even to the degree of marriage. Again, how many times you have people that you get married, well, I'm not want to be married. Why not? Because they don't meet my needs anymore. You're not meeting me. It's all about me, and I'm going to value you by the degree that you minister to me, that you meet my needs. And at first, Saul valued David because he helped him. But then we're told that Saul begins to become jealous of David. And he hears people praising him. And suddenly he says, well, wait a second. He's taking the people like him more than me. That might hurt me. He might threaten my popularity. He might threaten me in some way. And so although David wasn't doing anything wrong, because Saul's perception was that David is taking something away from me because the value of relationship was, what do you do for me? If you help me, you're my friend. If you hurt me, well, suddenly, in his case, it wasn't I'm going to reject him, but I'm going to secretly try to destroy him to make sure that he can't take anything away from me. And again, it's important to remember that Saul hid this for a long time. He continued to act publicly as if he was David's friend, while privately he worked to destroy him. Now, if you have your Bibles open, let's see this. Let's turn to the middle of chapter 18. And we're told in verse 14 that David had success in all his undertakings, and the Lord was with him. And so, again, it's likely saying that there's some period of time that's passing here. And we pick it up now in verse 17. And Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter Merib, and I will give you to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but the hand of the Philistines be against him." Now here's what's happening. If you remember, if you were with us when we looked at chapter 17, or if you remember the story of David and Goliath, when Goliath was lined up and everyone was hiding, Saul made some very public promises about the person who would go out and fight Goliath if he defeated them. So much so, when David showed up at the front lines and he asked people, you know, what's gonna happen to the guy that goes out and beats him? Look at what the people of the army, everybody knows this, look what they tell David. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel, and the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." Now, one of the promises that's very clear, everybody sees it, everybody knows it. He said, "I'm gonna promise to give my daughter to the man that kills Goliath." Everyone knew that promise. But now David has killed Goliath, everyone knows that. But Saul doesn't wanna give his daughter to him for the simple reason that as he becomes more jealous, he realizes if I give my daughter, well, that gives him even more credibility. He now is literally part of the family. He's a son-in-law of the king. And so what he does is he said, "Well, okay, now I promised you my daughter, and I want to give you my daughter, but what you need to do is you need to prove your worth." Now, he's already proved his worth. He already did what was said. But he says, "Okay, what I want you to do is you've got to win her by going and fighting against the Philistines, and if you win enough battles, then you will do it." And we're told, again, not everybody knows this, we're told privately his real motive is, if I get him to fight enough battles, you know, he's going to do something stupid, and he's going to get killed, and I'll get rid of him. So he's playing the part of the friend, but in reality, he's trying to destroy David. So we read that he goes out and he fights the additional battles, and he wins the battles. But then we come in verse 19. At that time, but when the time came of when Merib, Saul's daughter, should be given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Methobite, for a wife. So you'd see a double betrayal. Number one, I promised this, but now I'm going to change the terms. And you know, for a wrong purpose. And then when David fulfills the second terms, he pulls back his daughter again and gives it to another man. And what we see here is that we see that Saul is claiming to be a friend, but clearly he's not. Now look at what happens now in verse 20 and 21, because it becomes worse. Verse 20, "Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. And Saul thought, 'Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him.' Therefore Saul said to David a second time, 'You shall now be my son-in-law.'" Now, I want you to notice something that is really easy to miss, but it's really significant. Look again at what it says in verse 21. He said, Saul was pleased because he thought, listen, look what it says, "Let me give him to her to him, that she might be a snare for him." Now think about that. What does that mean? The implications, I think, are, when you think about it, are pretty clear. She never said about the older daughter that she would be a snare, and some people would say, well, it's because he's trying to fight. No, there's something about her. Only this younger daughter, Michal, that he's saying this about. And what you see here is, I think it's really clear, is that Saul knew his daughter, and he knew that she was not a woman of character. And he looks at it and says, okay, well, how do I really hurt David? Well, here I've got my daughter, and she's kind of a mess, and if I put David with her, she's gonna mess him up. You know, I've never been able to control her, and he won't either. And literally he's saying, okay, what's the most damaging thing I can do to him? If I can give David the wrong kind of wife, that's gonna damage him. That's what he's saying. Now, we're gonna come back to Michal a little bit more, but I want you to notice with Saul that his motivation was to destroy David. And he offered this woman as a blessing. In reality, his motive was it was something to be a curse. Now, just a little side note. If you're single, there's a great warning here about marrying the wrong kind of people. You know, it's and you look at that and you say, we can fall in love and think somebody's a blessing, but if it's not someone who have the, you know, the same, you share the same faith, boy, it can be a curse. Now, it was a custom at that time for the groom to give a gift to the father to offset the loss of the daughter in marriage. And, you know, you look at that and you say, well, what would be appropriate for somebody to give to the king for his daughter? And it would be a gift financially that would, you know, David as a shepherd could never afford. And but you need to remember, if you go back to chapter 17, Saul had already fixed that price. If you kill Goliath, I'll give you the daughter. And then he said, if you go and fight the battles, I'll give you a daughter. And now he comes back again and he changes the deal again. Look at verse 25. And Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he might be avenged, that he might avenge the king's enemies. Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Now what he says, okay, I want 100 foreskins, which means I want you to go kill 100 Philistines and take a part of the body. You know, it's, if you don't know what part of the body, ask your mom and dad. And all I know is that my daughter just got married, and I'm really glad that my son-in-law didn't offer me this as a bridal price. And I'm sure he's thinking, and I'm really, really glad you didn't ask me. You know, it just, it's kind of strange, but basically what you have here is Saul saying, okay, I want to kill him. So again, you got to go kill 100 people individually, hoping that if you go out and you do that, they're going to kill him for me. His motive is he's evil. But what happens is that David goes out and he does that. And he, you know, he kills 200 and he brings them back, and Saul then has to keep his word. He gives his daughter Michal to be married. And now, up until this time, everything has been behind scenes, but Saul continues to get worse and worse. And then we get into chapter 19, and he becomes obvious in it. Look at chapter 19, verse 1. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to his servants, and that they should kill David. And so now he goes on, he starts recruiting people to help him. It's not a secret anymore. And he knows that Jonathan is his friend, and we're going to come back to Jonathan, but he's trying to recruit it. In verse 19, we're told that he tries to kill David with a spear. In verses 11 and following, he sends soldiers to kill him. And in this whole time, you look at this, we've got to remember that what has David done to deserve this? Nothing. All he's done is helped. And here you have David, you know, Saul literally turning against him, hunting him down. Now, you know what? I hope that none of you have an army hunting you down and trying to kill you. I don't think many of you do. But you know what? We all will have times in our lives that people will treat us in a way that we don't deserve. Like David, it may be even someone who claims to be a friend, someone that we looked up to at some point in time, someone who has helped us. It might be a boss that's threatened by our success, a coworker who was our friend but now is trying to compete with us and trying to hurt us so that they look better. It might be a sibling who's jealous. It might be a friend who's upset, and it's, you know, suddenly what you had this great friendship and now they're against you. For some, it might even be a spouse that you trusted and has turned against you. And when we look at this, we see in David, you know, and we can relate to this. It's not only a pain of the actions, but it's confusion caused on top of this of what did I do? And how can I fix this? What could David have done? There's nothing he could have done to fix it. And for those that are, because we're all going to go through those periods. And I think of in my own life, you know, I think, you know, when I was younger, I'd be like, oh man, nobody holds anything against me. I wanted to fix every relationship and make sure that nobody had anything against me. And then I had people that turned against me and there was nothing I could do to fix it. And I love a verse in Romans chapter 12, because it says something that is so reassuring for these times. Verse 18, if possible, as far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. You know what I'm called to do is that I'm called as possible, as much as it depends on me. I'm called to, you know, as it says in Matthew 7, you know, to look at the plank in my own eye and to make sure there's nothing there with me that I have not contributing to this, but I can do everything, but there are going to be times that I will do everything that depends on me, but there are some people that aren't open to peace. There are some people that are going to oppose me. And that's where I have to turn it over to God. And I have to say, God, I can't fix this. It's in your hands. And it's because that happens that we need to realize and discern that we need true friends that are going to carry us through that time. So that's the first negative kind. The second time is that we have other people that will claim to be friends, but they are friends that are limited by spiritual weakness. And we see this especially through David's wife, or Saul's daughter, Michal. Now remember in verse 21 of chapter 17, we're told that Saul was happy to give her to David because she would be a snare. Now we start to see a little bit about why. Okay, look at verse 11. If you go to chapter 18, look at verses 11 and 12. We're told that Saul is now actively trying to kill David. Verse 11, Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, if you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. So Michal let David down through the window and he fled and escaped. Now there you see her acting in his interest. She's trying to help. Okay, but now here's where we see things change. We're going to see Jonathan act to help, but in a very, very different way than his sister. Verse 13, Michal took an image and laid it on the bed pillow in a pillow with a goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. Now, remember, Saul said she's going to be a snare. Now, what's this image? You know what this is? It's an idol. It's a household idol. Now, what is she doing at this house, worshiping as a worshiper of God, having an idol in her house? And not only that, why is David allowed that? And you see something about her spiritual state that she's spiritually compromised. She is not on the same page as David as far as worshiping God. She's got idols in her home. Not only that, you know, I just have to notice this. You know, look at verse 14. Her explanation, she covers this, puts this thing in here, and she tells, when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said he's sick. Now, I don't know if you ever think about this, but this calls into question something of her intelligence. Now you say, why in the world? Think about it for a minute. Saul sent a team of assassins to come kill David, and what does she say? Oh, he's too sick to be killed. You know, you can't come in now, he's too sick. Oh yeah, if he's sick, well, we'll just go ahead and we'll leave him alone. I mean, they're there to kill him. But she doesn't, you know, and so what happens? They go back to Saul and they say, well, he said he's sick. I told you to kill him. I don't care if he's sick before he dies or healthy. So then verse 15, Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him. And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed and a pillow of goat's hair at its head. And her brilliant ruse is foiled. He calls his daughter. Verse 17, he said to Michal, why have you deceived me and let my enemy go that he has escaped? And Michal answered Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? Now, I want you to notice the impact of this. It seems like she's trying to help. I think she is trying to help. She loves him as much as she knows how, but spiritually she's weak. And still she is looking at relationships as, what do you give me? And if you cost me too much, well, I can only give so much. Because look at, we're going to see in a moment, Jonathan defends David's character as dad. What does she do? She helps him escape, but then when it's, you know, she's at, you know, before her dad, she says, well, he said that he was going to kill me if I didn't let him go. Which plays into the lie that Saul's making about David. He's trying to get everybody to turn against David, saying he wants to overthrow the king, and suddenly her story is affirming the lie. It couldn't have done anything worse to hurt David. Now, you know, did she mean to do that? No, I think she was trying to help. She loved him as much as she knew how. But the fact is that she lacked character. She lacked the idea of the understanding of what true love is because she lacked a relationship with God. And so when push came to shove, she helped to a degree, but ultimately when it came down to her possibly taking a risk in her own life, she was only able to go so far. And what you see there is that she was a snare. And you're going to see later in David's life that she continued to be. And the Bible gives us warnings about this. It warns us that we've got to be careful about the relationships that we make. Look at, for example, 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. What partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Baal? What portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't have friendships. We should have friendships. We're building relationships, but it means those close partnerships, ultimately the closest being head of marriage. You know, that you look at that and you say, if we're not careful, we've got to realize that people can tear us down spiritually. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, don't be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. If we're hanging out with people that are living lifestyles that are against God, and those are our close friendships, sooner or later, they will be a snare. They will drag us down. Chuck Swindoll said it this way. He says, it's like putting on a pair of white gloves and picking up mud and mixing it around in your hand. He says, the mud never gets glovey. I've never seen glovey mud in my life, but invariably, the gloves get muddy. And so that's the whole thing, is that we've got to realize that there's a danger. So we need the right kind of friends, and the right kind of friend is illustrated with Jonathan. It's friends with godly character and a Christ-like love. And look what we see here. We see this incredible friendship. As Saul is turning against him, look at chapter 19, starting in verse 1. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And look at how he responds that's different even than Michael. And Jonathan told David, Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard in the morning. They both warned each other. But he says, now I will go out and stand before my father in the field where you're at, and I will speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I'll tell you. So he says, okay, I'm going to go out and warn you, but I'm also going to defend you. And you sit there, what you see is that at times, what Michael did, I'm going to warn you, but I'm going to save my own skin as well. Jonathan put himself on the line because it wasn't just about, okay, what can you give to me? It's, I'm willing to give to you even if it's costly to me. And so here's what happens, is that Jonathan goes and begins to speak to his dad. And as, and we read in verse 4, Jonathan spoke well to David and Saul and his father and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took a life into his hand and he struck down the Philistine, and the Lord worked great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoice. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Now, I want you to realize that a couple things here is that it may seem like Jonathan is being put in a place where he has to choose between loyalty to his dad and to his friend. And that's not how Jonathan saw it. And that's not how we should see it either. Because he's sitting there and he's being put in a position, his dad is saying, I want you to help me kill David. And Jonathan said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to choose right over wrong. And if I have a friend that tells me to do wrong, then loving them is standing for what's right. Being a loving friend doesn't mean that I agree with everything that you tell me that you want me to do. And if someone's making sinful or harmful decisions, the most loving thing to do isn't to support them in those decisions, but it's to speak the truth in love. That's what Jonathan did here for his dad. He spoke the truth, and it was the greatest support that he could give to his dad. Later on, his dad gets angry. His dad tries to kill him because of that. But he was always acting in love. He was never choosing David over his dad. He was choosing truth and character over sinfulness. My friends, that's a vital point that we've got to remember in the midst of this. But then as we look at this, he intercedes, and what happens? Michael, on the other hand, well, David said he was going to kill me. Jonathan put his life on the line, and in this case, he turned his dad around. And his dad said, you know what, you're wrong. I want to welcome David in. Now, later on, we see in chapter 20, we see that in chapter 20, Saul turns again, and Jonathan tries to intercede. And if we read in verses 30 through 32, that at that point it says Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. He said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman, I know that you've chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness. And you're looking and said, this is at the dinner table and she's probably there. And why is she calling? What's she saying about his wife? He had a long night that night. And, but he says, as long as your son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me that he shall die. And Jonathan answered as Saul, his father, why should he put to death? What has he done? And Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. And Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put Jonathan or David to death. And what you hear is you have this incredible commitment saying, I'm willing to love and care not only when you have something to give, not only when you don't have something to give, but even when it costs me, even when it's costly. Because what I'm going to do is that I'm going to love in a way that speaks the truth, that I'm going to love in a way that is going to pay the price. I'm going to love in a way with a commitment that transcends. Now, remember, Saul is jealous of David. He has nothing to be jealous of. Jonathan does. That, you know, he looks at this, and David could be a threat to Jonathan, to his role. He's a crown prince. But he looks at it, and he doesn't see, what can you take from me? What he sees is, he says, God's blessing your life. And you know what? I want to be part of God's blessing in your life. It's not what I may lose through it. It's, I want to participate in what God's doing. And it's illustrated. It's a Christ-like love illustrated. Look at Philippians chapter 2. It says, have this mind in us that was also in Christ Jesus, which is yours in Christ Jesus. And what is Jesus' example? Who, though he was in form God, did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. But he emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in human likeness. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Here's Jesus' love. He emptied himself. He gave of himself. He gave in a way that was costly for our benefit. Now we sit there and say, but if I do that, who's going to take care of me? You know, if all I ever do, then what happens to me? Am I a martyr and just giving of myself to other people? Well, it's right here in this passage. Look at what it says. Look at what happened to Jesus. Look at what happened, because it says that we are to have this mind in him. And if we see what happened with Jesus, it gives us a clue of how we should trust in this as well. Look at what happened. Verse 11. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. You know what it's saying? We would sit there and say, well, if I give, who's going to take care of me? And the answer is, God will. God will. Do you trust that God will? Do you trust that if I say, God, help me to serve this friend, help me to empty myself, and if I give of myself, God says, okay, you know what, I'll give you back more than you can give out. Do you trust that that's true of God? And it gives us the example not only of Jesus' faith, of his self-sacrificial love, but then of God's honoring that. And if that's the example, God honors it when we do it the same way. Now here's the challenge. When we look at this, we all want those friends, don't we? We need those friends. But the challenge is this, is to find authentic friendships. We've got to start by being a friend. You see, and again, when we look at this, what is the key difference? Is that, are we looking for people that are going to just serve us, meet our needs, we're going to value them to the degree they do, or do we have the love of Jonathan, who followed the love of Jesus, who said, I want to be able to find a friend that we connect on a spiritual ground, that we have a common faith in Jesus Christ, and then I want to have a friendship that says, I'm committed to meeting your need, even when it's costly to me. And the fact of the matter is that all of us can look at that and say, boy, I want that friend. And then we get frustrated when people aren't that kind of friend with us. Or maybe we even disengage from the church because people weren't there when we needed them. And the question is this. When we define whether the church is, or ask, is the church defined by Jonathan friendships or Saul friendships or Michael? You see, what I've got to ask is not how have people loved me. I've got to ask, how am I loving people? Well, people weren't there when I needed them. Okay, well, how about when they needed you? How about when they were going through the crisis? And the challenge is before God, if I can say, God, help me to be that kind of friend. Help me to empty myself. And if somebody let me down, you know, God, help me to realize that my job isn't just to love them when they meet my need. I don't want to be like a Saul who turns my back when they don't meet that need. I want to recognize, God, help me to be able to have a friend that loves people when they let me down. And help me to be that kind of friend like Jonathan, who loves people when it's costly to me. And if I do that, if I learn to love that way, then help me to trust that you will then meet my need. That you will then fill the need as I give myself out. And how do we do that? We recognize that ultimately the friend that we root ourselves more than any other is a friend that will never fail, and that's our relationship with God. It's interesting that even with Jonathan and David, when they swore this oath of friendship in 2042, Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for we have sworn friendship to each other in the name of the Lord. God is the basis of our friendship. And if you follow on, what you find is that Jonathan supported David. Jonathan was there. But you know, well, there was a time that Jonathan couldn't be there. Jonathan had to go back home. And then you look at Psalm chapter 7 and you read of David's struggle in the midst of this time. And look what he says in closing. He says, oh, this is written in this period of time in his life. He said, oh Lord, my God, in you I take refuge. Save me from all my pursuers. Deliver me. Oh God, Lord, my God, if I have done this, if there's wrong in my hands, if I have repaid my friend with evil or plundered my enemy with cause, let the enemy pursue my soul and overtake it. Let him trample my life to the ground and lay in glory. Basically, if I'm guilty of all that Saul is saying, then point that out to me. But then he continues, but God, I don't think I am. And because I am, I cry out, arise, O Lord. Lift in your anger, lift up against the fury of my enemies. Awake for me that you have appointed me a judgment. Let the assembly of the peoples be gathered around you. Let it return on high. O Lord, judge the peoples. Judge me according to my righteousness and according to the integrity that is in me. And basically saying, God, help me to not only love like you've taught me to love, but help me to find in you a security. That there will be friends that disappoint me. There will be times that I feel by myself. But if I find myself in you, you're a rock that will never fail. And so he invites us to find in Christ the ultimate security of the friend who will never fail and is the basis of our ability to love others and be there for them as well. Thanks for watching. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ, or church, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. The links are in the description.